The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the February 2022 edition of Education Today. We'll get started with an article from U.S. News, and it's entitled, School Mask Mandates Fall as Coronavirus Cases Decline. To mask or not to mask in schools has become one of the most politically divisive COVID-19 culture wars to spin out of the pandemic. By Lauren Camera and Cecilia Smith Schoenwalder, February 7, 2022. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy on Monday announced that he will lift the state's mask mandate for schools and childcare settings next month in a move that highlights a growing desire across the country to shift away from certain mitigation measures and into a, quote, new normal as coronavirus cases fall. We can responsibly take this step given the continuing drop in new cases and hospitalizations from Omicron and with all the evidence projecting a continued decline over the coming weeks, Murphy said at a press conference, adding that, quote, this is a huge step back to normalcy for our kids. He made clear that school districts can still decide to enforce their own mask policies. We are not removing the ability of individual district leaders to maintain and enforce such a policy within their schools, or any private child care provider from maintaining such a policy within their business should community conditions require, Murphy said. Likewise, any student, educator, or staff member, or visitor who chooses to continue masking up while indoors may freely do so. The announcement follows a decision last month by Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, also a Democrat, to nix the mask mandate for K-12 schools and comes as other Democratic governors are signaling similar shifts, including in neighboring New York and Connecticut. In Illinois, a circuit judge ruled to suspend Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker's executive orders on masking and quarantining for schools last Friday, though the governor said his attorney general would appeal the ruling immediately. To mask or not to mask has become one of the most politically divisive COVID-19 culture wars to spin out of the pandemic. While Democrats favor mask requirements in schools over Republicans, poll after poll shows that a majority of parents support masking requirements in school, a finding that's held steady for more than a year. The Biden administration has gone head-to-head with GOP-controlled states that adopted laws banning school districts from implementing mask mandates, going so far as to threaten to recoup American Rescue Plan funding from states like Arizona, which had plans to limit $163 million in federal aid to schools that don't require masks. The White House has also covered the salaries of school board members and district leaders in Florida after Republican Governor Ron DeSantis docked their pay for defying his executive order that bars districts from requiring students and staff to mask. Meanwhile, some states, including North Carolina, Ohio, Oklahoma, and Pennsylvania, have been experimenting with rolling back contact tracing operations, and at least a dozen states and the District of Columbia have adopted test-to-stay policies in order to keep asymptomatic students and teachers in the classroom after exposures. While universal case investigation and contact tracing during the initial phase of the pandemic was justified in the attempt to contain the pandemic, most experts in public health agree this is no longer optimal, Oklahoma's public health official said in a statement last week, noting that the shift will allow case investigators and epidemiologists to prioritize following up on outbreaks or clusters, as well as individuals in high-risk settings after a positive COVID-19 result. Schools experienced significant disruptions early in the new year as the highly transmissible Omicron variant caused infections and exposures to spike, leading to severe staff shortages and student absences throughout most of January. At one point, roughly 10% of the country's schools were forced to temporarily close or pivot to remote learning. But such disruptions are slowing, and the latest data shows that they dropped dramatically this week to levels not seen since October, according to the school tracking site Burbio. This week, the total number of schools that experienced at least one day of disruption dropped to 539, a 75% decrease compared to last week's total of 2,128 disruptions, and a drop of 93% from the yearly high of 7,462 disruptions during the week of January 10. Moreover, the average number of schools disrupted per day last week was only 182, according to Burbio, indicating that 99.8% of K-12 public schools were operating on any given day last week. The developments come as coronavirus vaccines are available for all children ages 5 and older. But vaccine coverage in children 5 to 11 remains the lowest of any age group, with just 22% fully vaccinated. Last week, New York Governor Kathy Hochul said that her decision as to whether to remove the mask mandate in schools would hinge not only on case numbers, but also vaccination rates among young children. It's something we get asked a lot about. When are masks coming off in schools? We'll be making some announcements in the short term as we see these numbers progressing, she said on Friday during a press conference. The more children we have vaccinated, the safer they will be when they go to school at the time they get to where they won't need a mask anymore, she said. It's something we're striving for, but we're just not there yet. Many public health officials and groups say it's too soon to relax mitigation measures, especially at a time when the U.S. is still averaging more new infections than any previous wave of the pandemic. And infections among children remain, quote, extremely high, according to a report from the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Children's Hospital Association. The American Academy of Pediatrics tells U.S. News in an email that, quote, it has not changed its recommendation calling for universal masking in the schools. And we'll cut that article short for time. This next article comes from NBC News, and it's titled, Puerto Rico Teachers Will Get a $1,000 a Month Salary Boost. The move comes just days after 70% of public school teachers left their classrooms and joined a protest for better conditions. Salaries had not increased in 13 years. Puerto Rico's public school teachers will receive a temporary $1,000 monthly salary increase starting in July, Governor Pedro Pierluisi announced Monday as he promised to make it permanent. The move comes just days after 70% of teachers left their classrooms and joined a protest to demand higher wages, better pensions, and improved working conditions. Another protest is scheduled for later this month. For years, we've truly been waiting for this moment, said Victor Bonilla, president of the Puerto Rico Teachers Association, which represents some 25,000 teachers. The base salary of public school teachers in Puerto Rico is $1,750 a month, a number that hasn't budged in 13 years. While some teachers praised Monday's announcement, union leaders noted that they are still seeking a base salary of $3,500 a month. Giovanna Ostolaza, who teaches 8th and 9th grade English at a school in the capital of San Juan, said it's very hard to live on a teacher's salary, especially for those who have families. She also worried that the governor might not come through on his promise to make the increase permanent. They have to prioritize education, she said. These are people essential to society. Puerto Rico economist Jose Caraballo Cueto noted that utilities are nearly 60% more expensive in Puerto Rico than the U.S. average, and groceries are 18% more expensive. However, healthcare and housing costs, among others, are lower in comparison, according to Puerto Rico's Institute of Statistics. The Teachers Association and others had rejected a smaller wage increase recently approved by a federal control board overseeing Puerto Rico's finances and the U.S. territory's exit from bankruptcy. Teachers would have seen an average increase of 27% compared with what they made in fiscal year 2019. They would receive half that increase on July 1st, with the other half tied to them finishing a payroll and attendance system and providing for student attendance keeping. Governor Pedro Pierluisi said he had been looking for alternatives after the board rejected his proposal to increase teacher salaries by $1,000 a month. He added that the additional money will come from federal funds, specifically the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Fund. He said the use of those funds is temporary and will give his administration time to identify recurrent state funds to make the salary increase permanent. Sibaris Morales Paniagua, interim general secretary for the Teachers Association, said they will make sure the increase is made permanent as part of a collective agreement still being negotiated and that they will continue to push for even higher wages. She said in a phone interview that the governor told them he also has identified funds to increase teachers' defined contribution pension plans. The next article comes from WUSA9, an affiliate of CBS News, and it's entitled Book Ban Busters. Moms across the country fight to stop book banning at schools. A group of moms, authors, and organization leaders spoke out against the rising movement of people attempting to ban books from schools and libraries across the U.S. Alanea Kremen, published February 4, 2022. It seems like more and more reports of groups attempting to have certain books banned from schools and libraries pop up almost daily in 2022. From Texas to Oklahoma to Loudoun County, Virginia, school boards are being asked to take books off the shelves. According to the New York Times, the pace at which groups of parents, officials, and lawmakers are challenging books has reached a speed many haven't seen in decades. Katie Paris is an Ohio mom and founder of Red, Wine, W-I-N-E, and Blue, the group behind Book Ban Busters. Quote, "The pandemic is exhausting enough. We don't need book bans too," said Paris. Book Ban Busters is a campaign made up of suburban moms and other partners who aim to fight against banning books from schools and libraries. Paris feels like the need to fight grows daily, as it seems there's new book ban news in the local and national media constantly. She pointed to a book burning event reported near Nashville as an example of why the fight is so urgent. "This is horrifying, but hardly surprising," Paris said, "because there is a straight line from book banning to book burning." In November 2021, Spotsylvania school librarians cleared shelves of books that were deemed, quote, "sexually explicit." The school board voted unanimously to remove the books, with two members even advocating burning the offensive books. Paris claims most books that are being targeted are not actually assigned books, but are simply on school and county library shelves. She said that she understands that parents may not want their children reading books that deal with certain themes, but asks those parents not to take away the opportunity to read and explore those books from other kids. "I just want to be clear here, be real about what the issue is here," Paris said. "The books being targeted are almost entirely about Black people and LGBT people. If sexual content was the issue, they'd be targeting Shakespeare or Ernest Hemingway, the Bible, and we'd be standing up against banning those books too." The group has launched the website banbookbusters.com in an effort to educate and help fight back against the book banning movement. The website includes an interactive map that shows all the attempts to ban books across the country and their status. It also provides a way to procure a banned book and ways to get trained in how to push back. "We call this our troublemaker training," Paris said. Red Wine and Blue is a group comprised of nearly 300,000 moms across the country. Several moms involved in the Book Ban Busters movement spoke alongside authors in a Zoom meeting Thursday. One of those moms was Rasha Saad of Loudoun County. Saad said that the fight to stop book banning is a subject near and dear to her heart. Having grown up in what she described as a, quote, "very conservative household," she said her school library taught her so much about her own self. "It helped me learn and grow. It helped me understand my own sexuality. So to take away these voices, to take away these stories from our students who are the most marginalized and who will most benefit from these voices is simply unacceptable," Saad said. Saad is a member of the group Loudoun for All. The group recently partnered with a local small bookstore to find banned books and later created an area at a school board meeting with a sign reading, "Get Your Banned Books." Saad explained that Loudoun for All combats the movement to try to remove marginalized voices and any attempts to remove the safety and equity that others have worked so hard to install in Loudoun schools. "The conservative effort to remove and roll back all of our amazing progressive changes will not stand," Saad said. Author Ashley Perez spoke alongside Saad in Paris. Perez is not just a mom, she is also a literature professor, former Texas high school English teacher, and the author behind the award-winning book Out of Darkness. Out of Darkness is a young adult novel set in a Texas oil town in 1937. It centers on a romance between Naomi, who is Mexican-American, and Wash, who is Black. Perez said while the book was published years ago, she only started to see it get banned in 2021. Perez was inspired to write her book by the students she taught in Texas because the books they wanted to read were not in the high school library. "Out of Darkness isn't for everyone. I never intended it to be," Perez said. "But it is the book for someone, and that reader deserves the freedom to find it in their high school library." According to Perez, Out of Darkness has so far been banned in Texas, Virginia, Utah, Kansas, Missouri, and, as of this week, Georgia. Julia Finley Mosca is a mother and author who lives in Ohio. As an author, she writes children's books that tell the true stories of women who work in STEM fields. She was shocked this fall to learn that two of her books were placed on a ban list in Pennsylvania. "I just couldn't imagine what was so controversial about them," she said. Mosca held up two examples of her books in her series that were not banned. Both featured illustrations of white characters on their covers. She then showed the covers of the two books that were banned, both featuring illustrations of characters that were people of color. "The two books in the series that were banned were the only two about Black women," explained Mosca. Mosca said what she found most upsetting about the banning of those books is that they are about truly hidden figures in history. One tells the story of Dr. Patricia Bath, a Howard University alum who invented laser cataract surgery. The other focuses on Ray Montague, naval engineer credited with creating the first computer-generated rough draft of a U.S. naval ship. She was the first female program manager of ships in the United States Navy. "When you are banning them, you are essentially re-hiding these women," she explained. "You're hiding their stories again from our children, from society." Jonathan Friedman is the director of free expression and education at PEN America, a nonprofit organization that defends literature and human rights. There seems to be no bottom right now to what might be banned or removed or challenged from schools, he said. The floodgates are open. Friedman said fighting the bans does not mean the organization believes all parents are coming at this issue with nefarious intent or that parents shouldn't ever have a say in what their children should have access to. There is a way to create systems in school libraries that don't result in books being banned for everybody else, and we have to embrace those solutions here to how we operate in a diverse society, Friedman explained, where the freedom to read, the freedom to think, the freedom to learn are shared core principles to which all can subscribe. The American Library Association keeps a list of the 10 most challenged books every year. The most recent list available is for 2020. It includes number 1, George by Alex Gino, 2, Stamped, Racism, Anti-Racism, and You by Ibram X. Kendi and Jason Reynolds, 3, All American Boys by Jason Reynolds and Brendan Keeley, 4, Speak by Laurie Halse Anderson, 5, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian by Sherman Alexie, 6, Something Happened in Our Town, A Child's Story About Racial Injustice by Marianne Solano, Marietta Collins, and Anne Hazard, illustrated by Jennifer Zivoyne, number 7, To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, number 8, Of Mice and Men by John Steinbeck, number 9, The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison, and number 10, The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas. Spotsylvania school librarians are clearing their shelves of books deemed, quote, sexually explicit after a parent complained of finding shocking titles on sexuality, faith, and race. Some staffers and students are now starting to push back on the plan. The next article comes from K-12 Dive, and it's entitled, Mental Health Curriculum Mandates Seek to Destigmatize Getting Help. California is the latest to add a mental health curriculum requirement in K-12 to help address the ongoing youth mental health crisis, by Anna Merritt, published February 2, 2022. About a year ago, Loretta Whitson heard a story about a student in California who stopped herself from going to a school-based mental health clinic after the student's peers teased her for trying to go. When Whitson, who is executive director of the California Association of School Counselors, heard about that student's experience, she began working with State Senator Anthony Portantino to draft a mental health curriculum requirement. I thought, how do we do this? How do we destigmatize mental health? Whitson said. On January 1st, a new law sponsored by Portantino took effect, mandating that the California Department of Education include mental health in state standards by January 1st, 2023. Districts must begin teaching the new curriculum by January 1st, 2024. The law requires that middle and high school students learn the signs and symptoms of conditions such as depression, suicidal thoughts and behaviors, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, eating disorders, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder. In California, students will also be required to learn how to seek assistance within their school system. According to the law, this will help promote awareness and allow for early intervention before a mental health crisis emerges. The California Mental Health Curriculum Law was enacted just months after the American Academy of Pediatrics and other organizations declared a national emergency in children's mental health. The organization said the crisis emerged from the intense toll of the COVID-19 pandemic, exacerbating already existing mental health challenges for children. Similar mental health curriculum laws have been passed previously in other states, including those first enacted in 2018 in Virginia and in New York. As of 2021, 13 states, not including California, had passed K-12 mental health education legislation, according to a report by Mental Health America, a nonprofit dedicated to addressing the needs of those with mental illness. Mental health lessons are needed in K-12 because instruction can help reduce stigma and normalize support, Whitson said. Seeking mental health support should feel as normal as going to a doctor for physical health needs, she said. The California law is a positive step forward, as students are likely going to face mental health fallout from the pandemic for years to come, said Hannah Wesolowski, Chief Advocacy Officer for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. NAMI is a grassroots organization advocating for mental health services and research. For Wesolowski, it's particularly critical that states are thinking about teaching students how to identify mental health conditions in themselves and their peers, including how to get help. We are deeply concerned around what the COVID-19 pandemic has done to youth mental health, Wasilowski said. The earlier we can intervene, the better we're going to be as we deal with a very long mental health tail to this pandemic. What's unique about the California law is that it considers cultural factors in mental health, she said, including the consideration of LGBTQ students who can face higher rates of suicide. As some conversations begin to push back against the term social-emotional learning in schools, Wasilowski said it's dangerous to politicize SEL and mental health efforts in schools. For instance, one Oklahoma lawmaker proposed legislation in January to remove SEL in the state's schools, KFOR reported, and another parent group organized in September in Southlake, Texas, calling districts to leave mental health and parenting to parents, NBC News reported. An Indiana group, known as the Purple for Parents Mission, explicitly states on its website that it's advocating to stop, quote, conditioning grooming of vulnerable children from programs like SEL. I think there is widespread agreement that our children's mental health is suffering right now, Wasilowski said. We're starting to see a tide shift, and I think state leaders are realizing that they have to do something. We're all going to pay the price if we don't address this children's mental health epidemic. Wasilowski and Whitson both agree more supports and policies are still needed to meet students' mental health needs. Also critical, they said, are efforts to make mental health days excused absences and provide more in-school professional support from counselors and social workers. The next article comes from NPR, and it's titled, School Leaders Say HBCUs Are Undeterred After a Series of Bomb Threats, published February 8, 2022 by Joe Hernandez. A week after a series of bomb threats against historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, across the U.S., public officials and university presidents are speaking out against what they've characterized as a racist attack against the schools and their students. They are disappointed. They are traumatized, Alcorn State University President Felicia Nave said of the school students and staff in the wake of the bomb threats. But they're resilient. And they are resolved to continue to move forward and to make it known that we won't be threatened, we won't be scared away. Michelle Asha Cooper, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Higher Education Programs at the U.S. Department of Education, said she believed the threats were designed to menace the colleges. While the interruption to learning is unacceptable, what is worse is that these acts were meant to intimidate and to invoke fear, Cooper said. The timing of these threats to coincide with the first day of Black History Month was a likely attempt to exploit tensions among some factions of our society, she added. Nave and Cooper made the comments during a virtual roundtable held Tuesday by the nonprofit Southern Poverty Law Center, which estimated that nearly 20 HBCUs had been the subject of bomb threats on January 31st and February 1st. Among those targeted were Howard University in Washington, D.C., Morgan State University in Baltimore, Edward Waters University in Jacksonville, Florida, Southern University and A&M College in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, as well as Spelman College in Atlanta, which received another threat on Tuesday. No bombs were found. The FBI is investigating the bomb threats as violent extremism and hate crimes. The FBI has identified 6 tech-savvy juveniles as persons of interest in its investigation into the bomb threats against HBCUs earlier this month, according to NBC News. One of the callers who phoned in a threat against Bethune-Cookman University claimed to be affiliated with the neo-Nazi group Adam Waffen Division, the Associated Press reported. This investigation is of the highest priority for the Bureau and involves more than 20 FBI field offices across the country, the FBI said last week about its investigation into bomb threats at HBCUs and houses of worship. These threats are being investigated as racially or ethnically motivated violent extremism and hate crimes. Cooper said the Education Department would continue to partner with the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security, which have been leading the investigations into the bomb threats, to potentially provide colleges with additional training and help them update their emergency plans to include physical threats, such as bomb scares. The college presidents noted that the bomb threats came at a politically tense time in the country, as some conservative states are moving to ban, quote, critical race theory in schools and outlaw books about the history of racism in the U.S. Walter Kimbrough, president of Dillard University in New Orleans, likened the current threats of violence to those activists faced during the civil rights movement. We try to make civil rights a finite period of time, and now that we have some new challenges, we're sort of trying to figure out, hey, what do we do with this, he said. We have to make a sacrifice sometimes, and we have to show that we are not afraid, Kimbrough added. The idea is to disrupt us, and it's not to say that there couldn't be a tangible threat at some point down the road, but we can't just stop doing everything. Today's final article comes from U.S. News, and it's titled, Education Secretary Cardona Has Big Plans for Equity. Are states and districts listening? Education Secretary Miguel Cardona has made inequity in the K-12 system a priority, but the nation's more than 13,000 school districts appear to be responding with varying levels of sincerity. By Lauren Camera, published February 8, 2022. When Education Secretary Miguel Cardona outlined the Biden administration's education priorities in a major speech last month, he didn't mince words when he told state and district leaders that they needed to do more to put equity front and center. We need our states and districts to take a hard look at their own ways of funding schools, and for those leaders to make the difficult decisions to fix broken systems that perpetuate inequities in our schools across the country, he said. It is our moment to finally make education the great equalizer, he continued, the force that can help every student thrive, no matter their background, zip code, circumstance, or language they speak at home. Addressing inequity in the K-12 system, Cardona added, will be the education community's hardest and most important work, work that they will be judged against. Of course, all administrations talk a big game when it comes to education equity. But for President Joe Biden, who assumed the White House amid a pandemic that exacerbated long-standing achievement gaps and locked low-income students, students of color, and those with disabilities out of classrooms longer than their wealthier, whiter peers. And for Cardona in particular, who ascended to the country's top education post after growing up in public housing and navigating public school as an English language learner. The focus is rooted in urgency and intimate understanding of the implications. That's why it looked so bad when mere days after the secretary's speech asking state and district leaders to, quote, level up, the school board members of Darien, Connecticut, Cardona's home state, voted down a program designed to address racial and economic disparities that exist between cities and neighboring suburbs by allowing kindergartners from neighboring Norwalk to attend their schools. Under the plan, 16 children from Norwalk would have the opportunity to enroll in schools in Darien, where the median family income is $230,000, roughly three times that of Norwalk, where 30% of students are Hispanic and half of students are still learning English. The program was backed by the superintendent and head of the school board, but opponents voiced concerns about class sizes and challenges related to the ongoing pandemic. It just wasn't the time, said Jill McCammon, Darien School Board's vice chairwoman. While Darien is just one of more than 13,000 school districts across the country taking Cardona's marching orders with varying levels of sincerity, the example begs the question, if a district in the secretary's home state won't make room for 16 children, then who will? And we'll have to cut that article short for time. We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.